If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to the Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys. Just a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
Ben, is that one of your famous cocktails in a Ziploc bag I saw you bring into your face?
No, I'm just having a little gin and seltzer.
That sounds nice.
A little Tanqueray and Topo.
I mean, that should have a rap lyric associated with it. It's nice.
Yeah, it's a nice drink. It's a nice, refreshing summer afternoon beverage.
I've been kitbashing the off-the-shelf Costco margarita jug.
Hmm.
To be clear, again, this is the one made with tequila and not the one made with wine.
Ooh.
Which I find to be a pretty solid choice, but I'll always overproof it a little bit with a shot.
So what is it? It's like bar mix with tequila pre-loaded?
I think you'd be impressed and surprised by the quality of this beverage. I do not like pre-mixed cocktails off the shelf by any stretch. And I gave this one a try because of the proud Kirkland name. And it did not disappoint. This is not one of those wine cocktails that you get at a music festival either. Like,
wow.
Real tequila. And Damn. It's not too sweet. This is the crucial aspect of it. It's actually got some good proportions, but dump another shot in there and then top with some club soda. That's how I like to take it.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
I have found myself in a situation where I've run out of a lot of key spirits in my repertoire. I'm usually an agave spirits or rum guy.
Everyone knows this about you.
And I'm out of tequila right now. I have
what?
One bottle of mezcal, but it's like an extremely special bottle of mezcal that was smuggled illegally into the country.
What?
I bought it at a liquor store where I was friends with the owner in Brooklyn, and he was
Did
like...
Did you do that with me? Do we have the same
yeah.
bottle?
Yeah, I think we do
there
both have the same bottle. So I don't want to like make a Wednesday night cocktail for myself with that. That's not what that's for. That's for special occasions.
You don't mix with the good stuff.
And I have no rum on hand except for another, like, equally special thing that is, like, almost out. And I can't just tap into that.
My wife and I did a party with a bunch of our friends before moving where we drank as much of our bar as we had.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't move it. And are you in that position right now ahead of a move? Like, you're not buying bottles because you don't want to move them?
Assuming this move happens, the buying bottles thing does feel a little bit silly to do right now. Although I don't know when the move will happen, if it does. So it might be like a month and a half. And like I can get through a bottle of tequila in a month and a half.
Here's the thing, Ben. You're going to need some tequila to get through the move. I think this is where I come in.
I think
a gift bottle of tequila is just what I'm going to get you. To help get you through this thing.
Well, this conversation went exactly as I hoped it would.
Oh, no. I've been played.
I've been played
by a confidence man, and here's the thing. I never would have suspected you as a confidence man.
You've been played, Adam, like a deck of cards, which makes me want to play with a deck of cards.
God, just a fucking professional quality pivot to game by Benjamin R. Harrison, like he hasn't done this for years on The Greatest Generation, let us have a card war.
We're at war.
There's been no formal declaration of war.
Maybe this trick will bring us some luck.
That nonsense is centuries behind us.
War! Go to war!
So we're doing a mismatched war today, right? This is asymmetric card war.
Right. I'm going to be red coats all lined up, ready to shoot a fusillade, and you're like in the jungle.
Yeah.
Ready to hit me from the darkness. And by that, I mean I'm playing with Star Trek Deep Space Nine Memories from the Future trading cards, and longtime listeners of the show will recognize these cards as the ones that stick.
Oh, boy. I am playing with customizable card game expansion packs for the Mirror Universe version of the Star Trek customizable card game.
Before we play, I must loosen my cards. Oh, yeah. So here is that sound.
Oh. That sound never doesn't suck.
It sounds like what it sounds like when I twist my back, like, which I do all the time. Do a little back cracking.
Somebody in the Greatest Gen subreddit posted a photo from an antique shop that they were in of customizable card game expansion packs that I had never heard of before. There is a Deep Space Nine expansion.
Really?
And there's a Holodeck Adventures expansion, and there's a Trouble with Tribbles expansion.
We've never played this card game, and I think that's fine. I don't regret that. Yeah. I don't think it would make a good episode if we were to do that. I think war is a better way to play it.
Yeah. With that, do you want to flip over a card?
Before we begin, does my piece of card count as a playable thing? I'm going to hold this up to the camera
for our
viewers at home to see, as well as you.
That's just like a scrap that was included in the package?
It was between a couple of cards. It just fell out as I was giving them the loosen up business.
Is it possible that that is what uniforms were made out of, and that's your scrap of uniform fabric?
God, that would be great. I keep opening these cards hoping I'll get a uniform piece, but yeah, I'm not going to play this. I don't think it would win, but I do have some cards here that I think have a good shot. So what do you say? We go 3, 2, 1.
Okay, Adam, the first card I have is a dilemma. It's a quantum fissure. Fragile intersection of countless parallel realities. An attempt to scan one using a subspace differential pulse was interrupted by a Bajoran warship with disastrous results.
My card, Ben, is also a disaster. It is Together at Last, one of Deep Space Nine's greatest moments. It's the romance between Odo and Kira.
Something you've long railed against.
My feelings are being sucked into a quantum fissure. Even considering this, which is more powerful, Ben, the love between Odo and Kira, or that gap in space?
Dat gap, though.
Or space gash.
I think your card wins.
Wow.
Mostly because I think it'll piss you off that your card wins.
The power of love. I'm too cynical to believe that, but if you insist, 1-0.
Okay.
Me.
3, 2, 1. Mr. Andrews, civilian, former Terran slave on Terak Nor in the Mirror Universe, liberated when the Rebellion seized control in 2372. I do not remember this man.
What I love about the customizable card game is that if you have been on camera, you have a card.
Yeah, totally. They are looking for content for the customizable card game.
Ben, my card is another greatest moment, and the title of it is Odo a Murderer? Odo spotted Ibudan on the station and recognized trouble immediately. Years ago, Odo had sent the Bajoran man to prison for murder.
Yeah, the bloom comes off the Odo rose in that episode.
It's episode 3.
Wow.
Wow, that's really going in the Wayback Machine. It does make me feel better about my dislike of Odo after that first card, though. It's Kira doing Fallen for a Murderer. I'll never know. Who do you think won this one, Ben?
I mean, Odo is a murderer and my guy is just some doofy white dude.
What's great about that episode is that Odo is a murderer. And I'll always believe it. I'm going to take the win. 2-0.
Fuck. I'm in a hole here.
Yeah.
All right.
You got to figure this out, man.
Yeah. Got to start flipping better cards over. That's what I got to do.
Will this be it? 3-2-1. There's no way that I'm going to win against whatever you've got, even though this is a special card. It's got some special foil on it.
Oh.
It is a Greatest Legends card.
Hmm. That is positively glossy.
It is, for some reason, Jake Sisko. Yeah, it's a card in honor of a main character. And for some reason, it's in honor of him. Looks like one of the specials. It's got a special number and everything.
Serac Lofton, he really grew up before our very eyes. He was such a cute little kid, and he's such a handsome young man at this point in the show.
I like his work.
Yeah.
I mean, we make fun of his character quite a bit because I think there's a lot to make fun of. But
that's the writing, not his performance.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you got, Ben?
I have the Cavort class Klingon bird of prey, the IKC Katang. This bird of prey fought in the Dominion War. It's immune to the Breen energy dampening weapon due to a fortuitous tritium intermix adjustment.
Wow.
So take that, Breen.
Cavort class.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure a bird of prey shoots Jake Sisko out of the sky every day, right?
I'm always going to respect a Cavort class because that's the type that took out the Big D.
You are right.
That's the ship of choice by the Duras sisters.
That's true.
They had the code to the shields because of Geordi's visor, right?
Yeah.
It would have been better if it were a missile or an exploding star that took out the D.
Yeah.
But instead it was just a fucking dumpy Cavort class.
Piece of shit. All right.
So it's 2-1, yeah?
Yeah. Do we go best of five?
Let's do that.
Okay.
3-2-1.
Adam, I've got an equipment card, and this is a piece of equipment that is less a piece of equipment than a running, not funny joke on Deep Space Nine. It is self-sealing stem bolts.
Man.
Used in producing reverse ratcheting routing planers, Jake and Nog traded 5,000 wrappages of Yamek sauce for 100 gross of stem bolts, which they sold for 7 tessipates of Bajoran land. That was the NoJ consortium that did that.
Sure was. I've got a card for one of Bashir's first loves. It's called Goodbye Melora. Melora was the guest crew person that had a hobby of turning off the gravity in her quarters.
Yeah.
and floating around.
She was like semi-avian person from a low-grav world, and she wheelchaired when she wasn't chilling in her bounce castle of an apartment.
Bashir, always falling for the wrong women.
Yeah.
Melora, it didn't work out.
Well, she didn't have any staying power, Adam, whereas the self-sealing stem bolt sure did.
Yeah, I think it's easily the stem bolt that wins this battle. Let's go to a fifth and deciding card, Ben. Yeah, what do you say?
The next goal wins. This is it. 3-2-1.
You're not going to believe this. No one is going to believe this. But my card is today's episode.
No kidding.
It's Bashir and Serena. It's two in a row, two Bashir relationship cards.
Wow.
It's the card for Krishalush.
That is a really adventurous pronunciation of Serena's name, too.
Was it?
Yeah. Serena.
Yeah, there's 1,000 different ways to say it. Interesting blocking of the card, though.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The faces are really down at the bottom in a weird way.
Yeah. A lot of headroom in the way they cropped that image. She's really looking on him lovingly.
They kind of float down into the title safe space that you don't want to be if you're shooting faces.
Yeah, his chin is like resting on the lower third there.
Yeah. What do you have?
I have an incident card, and my incident is Agony Booth. And this is an image from the original series episode about the Mirror Universe. I don't understand these directions. I don't think I'm smart enough to play the customizable card game.
I think you and I both know that Agony Booth is one of the most powerful cards in the deck, and I think what you did is you came from behind.
Wow.
After a 2-0 deficit, I think you've won 3-2 thanks to that Agony Booth card. Well done. Well played.
I kind of feel like this is the kind of victory that they were celebrating in Quarks after their Hollow Sweet baseball game last episode.
Yeah.
We didn't really win.
Yeah.
But we're celebrating as though.
Maybe we will go back and rescore this after talking about today's episode, Ben. Maybe at the conclusion, we will, in fact, have agreed that the Bashir and Serena card is the winner.
It's certainly possible.
Let's find out as we get into Deep Space Nine Season 7, Episode 5, Krishulish.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
It's also possible that we will forget that we thought of that idea.
Oh, it's probable. There is scene after scene of tragic solitude that Bashir experiences at the head of this episode.
This guy's social life is a fucking disaster.
I know, I grew up like this on occasion. Like, if your best friend isn't available to hang out with, you come to realize that your best friend may, in fact, be your only friend.
Yeah.
And if O'Brien is taken, I think that's sort of the situation that Bashir's in.
Yeah, that's not a good feeling. He's kind of like a pinball bouncing around the promenade from friend to friend, asking if he can tag along in whatever they're getting into, like Odo and Kira heading to a Hollow Suite date at their racially segregated Las Vegas lounge.
Well, have a great time.
They've really taken a hard right turn in their politics, apparently.
You know, I'd bring you, but you're not exactly...
You're a bit swarthier than what the doorman typically likes to admit.
It's pretty clear to me that the hood is docked on one of the rings, and I feel like it's always good on the hood if you're looking for something to do.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like an angle that Bashir takes here.
No. Well, the angle he winds up taking is going home and like doing homework.
Straight jacking saves you that mad cream.
Yeah, he goes home and punches one out. And by that, we mean he continues to work on projects.
And like stays up late working on projects? I don't get this. Like if I've got a night at home, I'm either going to enjoy my night by myself at home.
She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes.
Yeehaw! And like watch a movie or, you know, make myself an elaborate meal. But I'm definitely not staying up late to do either of those things. Fuck that.
Oh God, Ben. I understand now the awful truth about myself. I'm a Bashir.
Oh no. You're a stay up late for no reason?
I'm a stay up late and work on shit person.
Wow.
That sucks. Yeah. Bashir's just about to fall asleep when he's aroused by an incoming call from Nog. For some reason, Nog is the one to wake him up. Nog is on swing tonight, yeah. I guess.
I like it. And, this is a powerful course correct after the last episode posited a Nog as member of senior staff.
Yeah, this Nog is where you should be now.
This is exactly what Nog should be doing, is being ensign hospitality on the overnight shift.
We've reached a level of Nog equilibrium here, then it feels right.
Yeah. They've got an admiral that is asking specifically for the doctor.
Isn't Dr. Girani on duty?
Not anymore.
And that means jump out of bed, get in uniform, and run, don't walk, to see what this is all about.
When Bashir arrives in the infirmary, it's clear that Nog has fallen for a bit, and a belt buckle opens a lot of doors.
Yeah.
If you're to wear one. Unfortunately, in this case, it's Patrick wearing the belt buckle.
Yeah.
And it's the return appearance of the unauthorized X-Men in full Starfleet uniform.
Yeah, they are stealing valor. I think we need to call in the Sentinels, Adam.
Unidentified mutants. Ignore.
Yeah, it's wild. I don't get the sense that Nog ever gets it. Like,
no.
He's in the scene the entire time. Like, once we get it, I don't think Nog does.
Nobody ever stops to explain it to him, and I think that that's a really funny pregnancy in the scene.
Yeah.
The three verbal inauthentic X-Men have put on these uniforms to bring Serena to the station, and she's in the drab green outfit that we are used to seeing her in, but Bashir has actually been like trying to arrange for her passage, and the others kind of took matters into their own hands.
They sort of refer to a conversation where, and this happens a lot, like this is a case of Bashir saying, well, yeah, I mean, there's a chance that I could have some capacity to work on this problem medically. And then and then what he didn't recognize is that the people that he was telling that to would take that in a totally different way.
Right.
In a bring Serena here immediately kind of way.
Why are you so upset? You wanted Serena brought here? Well, here she is.
You know, after the opening credits, we get the scene where Bashir is being chewed out for having allowed a misunderstanding like this to take place. I mean, Sisko is freaked out that somebody posed as an admiral and like waltzed onto his station.
They meant well.
They meant well.
Very understandably.
The camera pans over to Garrix, and the exterior has one of those like temporary vinyl signs that says like your source for Halloween costumes. And it's like full of Starfleet uniforms.
He's doing a pretty good job with the verisimilitude.
Garrick goes totally uninterrogated here for his responsibility.
Yeah,
in this ruse.
Would they have gotten the uniforms on? Were they coming from Earth? Where'd they come from?
It feels like this is a thing that sort of like you can't put money in a copy machine and make credible looking money. You shouldn't be able to replicate a Starfleet uniform for some reason.
Yeah. I think that it's interesting that in real life you kind of can't. Like, I've never seen somebody in cosplay that looked right. And I would love to.
It's the pursuit that's meaningful.
It's a great point. And it's not shade against cosplayers. It's just for whatever reason, the way things are made and tailored.
Yeah. Like, I would love to see somebody walking around at STLV in a uniform that fit them the way Sisko's uniform fits him, you know?
I wonder how much of it has to do with carriage. Like, an actor has a certain way of wearing a costume that is really specific to the craft.
Yeah.
And when you're walking around a Las Vegas casino floor, a person wearing a uniform like this is just not going, like, they're not going to have it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, what I'm saying is Patrick has it.
That's a stupid question.
Yeah.
He has it in spades. He has it in belt buckles even, because there's a power that the belt buckle gives that that is really great for his character.
I love that he's able to inhabit a role too. Like, he is, like, we spent an episode with this character before, and we know that he is like a kind of silly and somewhat emotionally needy guy. And the point of these characters is that they're not really capable of taking care of themselves. But when he gets into character, he can really plausibly give Admiral realness, you know?
And that's a credit to the actor. Like, he's playing Lenny 1 second and then like abruptly switches course to asshole Admiral.
Yeah.
And it's great.
And I think it's a credit to the writing too, because like, to give a Lenny character like an ability like this is really fun and clever, I think.
So the project here is Serena. And he's motivated by a kind of survivor's guilt, isn't he?
Yeah.
Like he has survived his circumstances in a way that these X-Men have not. And it inspires him to forgive an incident like this, to encourage Sisko to forgive it as well.
Yeah.
And to work his best to cure Serena of her problem.
Right. The thing he's discovered is that, like, her being nonverbal is the primary side effect of her genetic resequencing, and he may be able to solve for that in a way that would enable her to live a relatively normal life. And, you know, I think this episode, like, a couple of times hews close to something that is probably more controversial now than it was then, which is the idea of, like, making somebody who is, like, neuroatypical behave more like somebody who is not.
More normal. What's normal?
And to my mind, it doesn't really, like, cross a line into, you know, making an offensive statement about, like, people who are neuroatypical or anything. But it struck me in this episode in a way that it didn't really the last time we saw these characters, that, like, this is somewhat chewing on the idea of, like, autism spectrum disorders or whatever.
I mean, it feels like it is suggested, but characters themselves, through dialogue, make clear that this is a locked-in syndrome sort of thing instead of a...
Yeah.
Instead of what you're describing. And I think it allows them to be off the hook for that.
Yeah. I also kind of wondered, like, what they were trying to optimize for in the... Like, especially in the other three characters, like, what they were trying to... Because, like, Lauren... It seems like all they did was turn up the potentiometer of sexual innuendo. Like,
right.
Everything she says has to have, like, a sexy lilt to it. But that's it, right? Like, that's the only thing she does.
Yeah, it's a strange group. Luckily, Sisko arranges for the cargo bay to be set up in exactly the same configuration as it was.
We kept your bedroom just like you left it.
Yeah, it's nuts.
It's the kids coming home from college and realizing that they're going to be staying in their 13-year-old style bedroom. Let's do it in my twin bed, twin
bed. So Bashir has an idea for how to work on Serena, and it's a procedure that he explains to O'Brien, but really us. There's a device that he can use for the procedure. It looks suspiciously like a clip show device.
But it's
going to be insufficient for his needs. And O'Brien tells him, I can't fix this piece of shit. Like, I'm the best on the station, but there's nothing I can do. Fortunately, the undeterred X-Men get their hands on this thing and get it working like it should.
Yeah, they are not trying to break the laws of physics, but they're perfectly willing to bend them. And right. So they've augmented this thing, but it's a bit of a cable nest issue. Like, they've taken what looked like a nice, clean piece of kit and really kit-bashed it to hell.
There are grips on this production that are getting migraines looking at how this thing is cabled.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that the art department just stationed a set dresser next to this thing to keep the grips away from it, because they would just come reflexively try and neaten out the cables.
You want me to inside outside wind these cables when I put it away, right? And they're like, no. Like, make sure that these cables get a memory to them. We want it to look like shit.
This is a hot prop. Do not touch.
Surgery day comes, and the clip show begins. We throw to the greatest moments of Serena's time on Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. And at this point, I think you and I will play a couple of those. Great stuff.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
The surgery does not go well, Enterprise.
Yeah, they're kind of expecting her to wake up from this and just be a chatty Cathy.
You'll be swell. You'll be great.
And when she wakes up, she is still doing the 1,000-yard stare with the dark spots under the eyes. And Bashir is, like, really disappointed himself.
War as hell.
So disappointed that he seeks the advice of a professional psychologist in Esri Dax. And her psychological approach here is basically, fuck your feelings, Bashir. You're going to beat up on yourself? I'll beat up on yourself for you.
Glad I could help.
I think we can be sure at this point that Esri is not a competent therapist.
I liked it. I liked the tough loveness of it. I think she read him in a way that he needed to be read in that moment.
I don't know, man. I feel like at this point, after five episodes, that there is a sense that there's no need to write Ezri any further than how we're getting her, because there's a little bit of short timer syndrome in character development happening. Like, what's the point? I suspect that this is all we're going to know about her going forward.
Well, this scene ends with them kind of cutting their, shredding each other emotionally short, because Serena has left Six Bay and is wandering around on the promenade. And Bashir walks up and asks her if she's okay. And she starts responding to him.
You hurt me.
And is like totally blown away that when she responds to him, he can then respond to her. It's like a whole new technology for her.
It really shakes up the episode. We cut to black, and then the Star Wars scroll appears, and it says Deep Space Nine, Season 7, Episode 5, The Mute Speak!
Her manicure is really on point for somebody who's been checked out of society for as long as she has. Because she does that thing where she like reaches up to her mouth in awe of its power.
In awe of her mouth's power?
Those nails, though.
Yeah. The makeup department did a lot of heavy lifting for the character development side of this episode, because as a nonverbal person, Serena had the Halloween store dark shadows painted under her eyes and around her eyes.
Yeah.
And was incredibly pale. And what she looks like after becoming verbal is a lot more lifelike,
yeah.
Especially in the face.
It's nice.
You're right.
One thing I commented on the last time we saw her on the show was that I thought she did a lot with a character that didn't have any lines.
Yeah, we agreed.
And one thing I read was that they were taking this script into production and they had Faith Saley come audition to play this part again because they didn't know if she could handle it or not. And I was shocked by that because she'd carried some of the scenes in that last episode without lines. And it was obvious to me that she had like the talent to pull off a second round with this character, but apparently not so for the producers of the program.
I wonder how emboldened you are when you're casting a show by the idea of casting Zial with a couple of different actors, or Quark's mom with a couple of different. Like, you get used to the idea of casting for taste in a way that I think makes bit parts like this subject to that kind of thing.
Yeah, but this is a part where she's not in loaf. I was really surprised to read that. I thought that was really remarkable. And I think that it is a real credit to Faye Saley's talent, how she plays this role going forward. Because like, there's some really subtle stuff that she does. Like the way she decided to portray somebody kind of being unused to having a voice. Like it is a very unique take on that idea that I thought was really good. And like the way she kind of like subtly backed off of how strange her voice sounded over the episode to where she had like some confidence with it.
Yeah.
I thought was really great.
Why are you talking like that?
Quiet.
I want to give the director, Jonathan West, some credit for this because like so many actors are given direction that involves backstory and motivation. And if your method, like finding areas of your own life that corroborate with a character need. And what's so interesting about Serena's character is that she has no such thing. And so the direction as given to her was to be totally receptive instead of telegraphing anything as if you have a backstory.
Right.
And it influenced her performance in a really unique way and in a way that really worked.
It's very cool to see. I mean, like, Faye Saley's like mostly a radio personality now, but I think is a super, super talented actor. And I really liked her performance in this.
There's some real emotional whiplash that happens after she becomes verbal and kind of comes alive. She gets reintroduced to the group, which is a moment where she's made fun of by her so-called friends for being tone deaf. And then we get a 2-minute a cappella scene with the Barbershop X-Men.
Boy, this scene has to work if it's going to work. You cannot B plus this. It has to be nailed.
Do re mi fa sol la ti do.
Do re mi fa sol la ti do.
I think the reason that this sequence worked for me was because of how it was shot. Like, there's a lot of physicality to it, the way characters move in and out of frame.
Yeah.
That I don't think you get if you back the camera off wide and see where Bashir is in relation to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, your proximity to them is a big reason why this is meaningful. And you only ever see Bashir, I think, toward the end. And I really like that about it.
I had goosebumps watching the scene. I mean, it's like a very, I don't know, it's like, it's one of those things where I was like, God, this is like a corny Star Trek moment, except for it is humming. Like, it is so good.
It's got that quality of an SNL sketch. So many SNL sketches begin, like, with the idea.
You like it, the juice, huh?
And then they just start hammering it over and over and over again. And the comedy dips for its frequency, and then for some reason pulls out of it for its frequency, too, in like, the third minute.
Would you mind ending this sketch?
And I feel like the sincerity of this scene works in the same way, because in the beginning I was like, this is cheesy and bad. But the longer it went, the better it got in that same way.
Their harmonizing is like actually really, really sweet. And I don't know if they dubbed everybody or if this is their actual voices or whatever, but like it works. Like however they made it work, they made it work. And that's a real accomplishment.
The trivia about it is that Jack was the actual tone deaf one and everyone else could really sing, and Faith Saley did not know she was the singer that she was before this scene. Like, she discovered that she had great pitch, which is a discovery I've never made about myself.
That's fascinating. Like, can you imagine being asked to re-audition for a part that you've already played once? You get to set and they're like, here's the script for today. It involves a lot of singing. And you don't know that you're good at singing?
It's the cliff jumping of acting challenges, you know?
Wow.
I'm frequently reminded of how awful a singer I am every time I karaoke.
And gets the call very late at night.
The singing works in this scene, but the thing that really works is how she goes from starting the scene being dunked on and made fun of and made to feel less than. And by the end, she is confident. She's engaged with them. She has won them over. And it's that emotional arc that undergirds the whole thing. It's like it's like the scene in the episode that I care about the most by far.
Well, we can't be here forever, Ben. We get Bashir's heart eyes emoji at the end of it into a scene at Quark's where Bashir is excited about a day he's had at work and he wants to share that with his best bud. And O'Brien is clearly bored of this subject.
Yeah.
You should have seen her, Miles.
How could I? I've been sitting here all night.
Bored to the extent that he's like rolling his eyes at Bashir.
It's not like Bashir falls in love every season. It is kind of a rarity.
Yeah. It's actually kind of a twist of the knife that Bashir is this excited, because what he has done is blown off an established hang that he was supposed to have with Miles. And Miles sat there with his dick in his hand like a chump.
Yeah.
So he's trying to be happy for everyone, but he is primarily concerned with himself.
So they go their separate ways, having had their mandate blown. Bashir goes back to his quarters and discovers Serena inside. She had no problem with the 6-digit access code that it takes to break into his apartment.
She was like, oh yeah, the face ID? I made this mask that looks exactly like you out of clay.
The alphanumeric keypad code for his apartment is PISMAN.
I was looking at those combination code door locks the other day, and I feel like those, like, if you use that to get in and out of your place, aren't the numbers going to wear out eventually, and just it's going to be very obvious, like, oh, these are the four digits that they use?
Before I moved to LA, I used to stay at an Airbnb not far from your place, Ben, and it had one of those keypad locks, and you're exactly right. The numbers used for that location were like they were worn.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
That does not work.
So she's there, but it's not seduction like you might expect. Serena's there because she can't sleep. Again, not seduction. She's got a very real feeling concerns about, like, what if I go to sleep and I wake up and I'm the way I was this morning? Like, I don't want this ride to stop.
Yeah. It's that anxiety of, like, I got to a thing that I have wanted to my whole life, and what if it goes away? What if it all suddenly goes away? Like, I mean, I think about that with getting to do this show with you. Like, what if something happened where we had to stop? It's terrifying.
Yeah, it could happen any day now.
Almost every day I think about the possibility, the distinct and real possibility.
It's a real Good Will Hunting scenario every time I turn on the recording feed. And I wonder if this is the day that you're not there. And you know what, Ben? That's the best day of my life.
What are you doing now?
Exactly.
I think this is a very high degree of difficulty scene to do and not make look pervy, because she falls asleep on his shoulder and he is content to fall asleep sitting up in a chair, and there is no suggestion of
he's not
physical,
like,
romance here.
He's not like putting his arm around her shoulder and putting a hand on a boob or anything.
Yeah, it's very chaste in a nice way, in the way that you hope it'll be.
But then, like, the next morning, she's, like, you know, getting him his breakfast and stuff in a way that was, like, is she, like, a 1950s housewife now? Like, what?
Where does she get this idea is a great question.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, they explore that in the episode, that she feels like she owes him so much that she could never repay, and her ideas about how to go about starting are very rudimentary.
This is such an interesting direction to take her character in the story, I think, that she's motivated by guilt, or maybe owing Bashir for what he's done for her. She doesn't want to be confused with being an ungrateful X-Man.
Yeah, she would hate that. So he goes off to work, and she goes back to her friends who are working on the problem of the inevitable collapse of the universe on a millions of years kind of time span.
This is the curse of great intelligence, right? It's the curse of empathy. It's the curse of so many ways of being, that, like, a person only has a certain amount of capacity for concern. And so this group of very smart people have become concerned about something very, very, very far into the future.
Yeah.
And it feels very present in the now.
It kind of feels like they got hooked on the idea of everything falling apart in their last episode with their prediction that the Dominion War would go far worse for the Federation than is generally known. And now they're onto an even bigger scale of looming catastrophe that they're interested in.
What the scene does intentionally is to make Serena different in a different way from the group. She's not fitting in the way that she used to, and it's something that she feels and the group does.
Yeah, because when Bashir finds her in there later, like, she has kind of fallen back into old habits, sitting by herself in a corner, staring off into the middle distance. And he's really worried that, like, the spell has been broken and she's turned into a pumpkin or whatever.
It's consistent with how she behaved in the scene before, right? She's doing this for their benefit. They're more comfortable with her acting a certain way. And so that's the way she chooses to be.
Yeah, which I like. I like the writing of that. Bashir invites her to a social hang, and to her credit, Lauren understands that this is not an invitation to the group, and helps Serena get ready for the evening's hangs. But Patrick and Jack are pretty ripshit about this situation.
Figures. That doesn't seem fair.
They feel very insulted, very slighted.
If this is Serena's Rumspringa, I feel like she got an Amish makeover here, right?
Yeah, the...
Like, she clearly looks... She looks really pretty, and she looks cared for by Lauren, but also, like, that dress goes all the way up and all the way down.
Yeah, the Empire waist dress is a very, like, specific... choice, I feel like.
Yeah, I think this is an example of costuming telling us that this isn't a sexy thing. Like, get that out of your head.
Right. And it's like a social hang at Quirk's where everybody else is in uniform too.
Yeah, even Odo's like, boy, she's pretty uptight, isn't she? And I'm me.
She could stand to loosen up a little bit.
This is a scene that ends with her and Bashir kind of wandering down the promenade together and her kind of psychoanalyzing all of the not Cisco senior staff.
Bashir's like, you know, you're doing your job better than Ezri could ever do.
Have you ever thought about a career in psychology?
This is kind of the pivot though, right? Like, what is her future going to be? She had such a great experience with Bashir's friends. The possibilities are endless for her. She's got this great big universe. Bashir's like, what do you think about sticking around, maybe? You don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah. The idea of picking a star...
Second star to the right.
...and heading off to it and making a life for yourself is great, but Bashir is starting to reveal himself as an unethical X-Man. And... the scene ends with him making out with his patient.
It's clear that unlike the group in the shuttle bay, she's not an unwelcome X-Man. But what Bashir does is break the news to these unhappy X-Men that they have to go and she gets to stay, and that's how it's going to be. They bring up a great point in response to this.
Couldn't you make us normal like you did for Serena, and then we could all stay together?
And I wish this was interrogated a bit more in this episode, and I had wished for this to be a stronger point of conflict. We've known these characters now for a couple of episodes. The why her and not us-ification of how they feel about Bashir, I feel like could use a lot more juice. Because if I'm Patrick or Jack or Lauren, I'm looking at the success story play out and I'm like, well, I'm next, right?
Yeah, and I think that the problem is that whatever it is that makes them incapable of taking care of themselves has never been very clearly defined. Like, they're obviously eccentric and weird.
They're undiagnosed X-Men.
Yeah, but like if Lauren had stabbed three people.
Lauren does take out a 4-inch clit and is like, this is my problem. Thump.
I would say that my main problem right now is that I'm an unfucked X-Man.
I could have used a little more of this, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, really stick it to Bashir. Like, he gets off a little easy here.
Like, if we all are, like, roughly contending with the same problems, why can she be fixed and why can't we?
Yep.
Is a great indictment of what happened here. And I don't feel like what's broken about them has ever been made entirely clear.
It also gives the story cover, too, because if you don't know exactly why, you're assuming there's a good reason.
Later in Quark's bar, Bashir and Serena are hanging out, and she's kind of rain-manning the Dabo table.
Explain how you track the dependent variables.
It's really not that interesting.
Dabo!
And that is always an anxiety trigger for Quark, who does not like to lose money to people who are capable of doing better math than he can. I would have loved to see her play some tango with him, though.
Right.
Like, after that episode where Bashir was bested by Quark, the case being made here is that, like, she has retained all of her genius, all of the advanced abilities of her genetic enhancement, and lost all of the disadvantages.
I mean, nothing cures a bum out of the previous scene more than a winning gambling streak.
Yeah.
And everyone's super jazzed in the scene, except for Quark, who strongly encourages them to go to the bar. He's acting as the cooler here.
Yeah.
And and it's in this scene that Serena begins to feel a little frazzled by the noise. And the suggestion here is that her cure may not be permanent.
Right. There's a kind of sensory overload thing happening that she can't really handle, so she wants to clear out of there.
When Bashir walks her home, Ben, he floats the idea of Risa, and this begs the question, how soon is too soon for Risa if you're dating someone in the 24th century?
Yeah.
I think generally everyone knows what a third date means, you know, contemporarily, but like, in the 24th century, I think a lot of thought needs to be given for when is Risa right for you?
Yeah. I mean, the question everyone asks themselves early in a relationship is like, this seems to be on a collision course for us being an item. And if that happens, then we will need to start like planning things around each other, like trips, holidays, all of that stuff. And Risa, like, it's one thing to meet and fuck somebody at Burning Man. It's another thing to go on a first date and on the second date be like, hey, what if we went to Burning Man next week?
It's so great. Like, there's no other use for a sex toy in the way that, in a way that, like, Risa only means one thing.
Yeah. He brought his jazz horgon on this date.
She seems game, even though she shouldn't know what Risa is.
Yeah. Unclear how much she's absorbed over the years, I feel like. But also, like, in the 24th century, like, the sexual mores have got to be much looser, a lot less, right, like Bible-thumping lunatics running around trying to enforce their weird Puritanism on everybody. And maybe people are just, like, more...
You hope so.
You know, like, maybe there are fewer venereal diseases. You can wave a light over your junk and get rid of your gonorrhea or whatever.
Later, Bashir gets another crack at O'Brien. Like, this seems to be their relationship right now. Bashir excitedly telling O'Brien about a thing, and O'Brien just not trying to hear that, really. But unlike the scene before, O'Brien, I think, really has some good, tough love style advice for him. And this is the hardest part about being really good friends with someone, is like the obligation to see two trains on the same track heading for each other and seeing if you can do something about the impending crash.
Yeah.
And O'Brien in this scene makes a pretty credible case for this being too soon.
Oh, we're genetically engineered. We do everything fast.
And also that it's his patient.
I thought this was a great scene for O'Brien because he says the thing that I was screaming at the TV the entire time. Like, you are pedal to the metaling your summer love with your patient. You're a fucking doctor. And this is a bad episode for Bashir. It makes Bashir look like grotesquely unethical. But also, I feel like it's very true to his character the way they write this, because he's engaged in what Dan Savage calls dickful thinking. Maybe I can fool myself. And he's a very arrogant man. Like, he believes in his advanced abilities, and he's like, well, I've like had the other doctor take over supervision of her care. She's no longer my patient. That's not no longer an issue. He rationalizes in a way that is like authentic to the way he's been written.
I think that's a great point. And it's destructive because the measures he takes are retroactive.
Yeah.
He does a bunch of unethical stuff before ethically making some decisions here that insufficiently retroactively could get him off the hook. And it's a great O'Brien episode for Bashir's failings. And O'Brien also knows not to push him too hard either. Like, Bashir's saying things that are big red flags for any friend who's close to someone who's making a mistake. When you start using language like, this person is who I've been waiting for my whole life, the idea of a person's ability to complete someone else, like, this is not rational thinking.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous.
As my dad's cousin said to him when he was 11 years old and visiting North Carolina and walked out on a railroad bridge, dangerous as fart.
That's wisdom right there.
It's just like that, Adam.
So that night, the candles are lit, the table is set. Here's what you want to do when you're on a date in the 24th century. You don't want to replicate the meal before your date arrives. And so these plates sit empty for what seems like hours and hours because Serena never shows.
I loved the shot that established that she never showed because it cuts around the room a couple of times and then cuts to a like camera pointed straight down at the table, but on a dolly. And it dollies over to find Bashir just like collapsed on a couch, just like bored out of his fucking mind.
He's got to find out what happened. He asks the computer where she is. Computer says that she's in her quarters. So there is where Bashir goes. And using his medical access, he breaks into her apartment and sees her staring out her staring window.
And in this moment becomes the unforgivable X-Man.
I don't know. I think I want to argue the other side. In this specific moment, I think you could believe that there has been a medical emergency if she's not responding to him being at her door.
I think that is fair, but it can't be him to go through the door in that context.
You like, got a call for backup.
There is too strong a chance that it is him that has driven her to whatever medical crisis is taking place.
And in the infirmary is where they discover that there's been a little bit of a backslide in her progress medically. It's something that he can't figure out on his own, and no one in the infirmary can, so he appeals to the unhelpful X-Men for their assistance, who seem unenthusiastic about this kind of work.
Why should we help you? You just want to steal her away from us.
Given that a few scenes ago, we were shown just how unhappy they were about all the attention being paid to her and instead of them.
Right. They still resent him for the idea that he's going to be breaking up their quartet. But despite that, out of loyalty to her, they go talk to her. And they have some debate, right? Like they talk over whether they want to admit to Bashir what's really going on, and they decide that they have to. So they come to his quarters and say, like, listen, like, she has not backslid. She shut down because she is fucking like overwhelmed basically by what's happening to her, and it's his boner that's overwhelming her, you know. If he allowed her to like adjust to her new ability to engage with the world without turning it into fucking candles and single roses and vases and champagne on the second date and Riza on the third date. The problem is she's been given no breathing room.
Healthy relationships are ones where both people remain their own separate identities, and then they bring those together while keeping those identities. And what happened here is that Serena's identity was subsumed. It became all about Bashir and the payback, and she lost whatever hope she had of becoming her own person very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, the thing that didn't hit me while I was watching the episode, but hit me as we started to discuss the episode, is that scene where she shows up at his apartment and like sleeps on his chest or he sleeps while she like lies on his chest and looks at his virology research. It plays so powerfully into Bashir's primary sense of weakness.
Yeah.
That she wants to connect with him on a human level, and that he has never been able to connect with anybody on a human level in this show, retroactively because of his augmentations, but also because of just like what a creep he was written as for the first season and three quarters. He is unforgivable for having responded to that out of weakness, because he should be a professional and should be able to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what's hard to forgive is that this was not a secret to him. Her desire to repay the debt was on the surface.
Right.
And that was specifically the moment that he should have disengaged and gotten some distance. That was the moment.
Right. But he's also, this is a guy that is authentically lonely. That is,
yeah.
This connection is so, it's such a powerful temptation to him that he violates himself to be receptive to it.
Doesn't it feel a lot like Data? Like Data's loneliness and Bashir's loneliness seem very related.
Yeah.
Like Bashir's desire to find an equal or a semi-equal gets him into a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
In the way it did for Data.
Honestly, like I've been watching The Sopranos lately, and there's a character on that has kind of a in and out relationship with drugs, where he's like sometimes doing tons of heroin. He goes to rehab. He's in AA. He like relapses mm-hmm. sometimes. He's on the straight and narrow sometimes. And those moments where he breaks and somebody offers him, you know, a key bump of heroin.
Yeah.
You know, like 2 days later, you catch up with him and he's like shitting himself at the fucking Feast of San Gennaro because he's so strung out.
Great scene.
This felt like that, like Bashir not engaging his higher functions to do the right thing in these moments.
Where's Bashir's cleaver as a film project? I bet he'd make a fun horror film.
I bet Bashir really loved Kundun.
That's the line of the episode, Ben. Fuck, that's great. So in Quarks, O'Brien hears about the aftermath, and the unemployed X-Men are heading home. Meanwhile, Serena is headed for a research project.
This is sad stuff.
What's cool, I think, is that Serena didn't backslide back into nonverbal. Like this, I think a lesser episode would have had her go back into catatonia and then like rejoin the X-Men and then go home. And then like, what was it all for?
Right. Yeah. Oh, Bashir, your skills are not as great as you thought they were. And also you're a bad person.
Right. And this episode is just about one of those things.
Right.
Which is, I think, better.
I agree. And I also think that the position O'Brien takes is exactly the right one. The subtext is "I told you so," but the text is "Hey man, I love you, and I'm sorry that this hurt you."
You didn't want to be lonely anymore. Nobody does.
One of the things that I feel like we've brought up before is just how much O'Brien has been through as a character, and how reluctant he is to bring that up as a form of currency he's willing to trade with the characters around him.
Mm-hmm.
O'Brien has been through this with Molly just a few episodes ago. A nonverbal character he tried to get through to.
Yeah.
And all of the fallout from having an emotional connection to someone and then having that confused with how you want to help them medically and how there might be a conflict between those two impulses. Like, who better than O'Brien to hash this out with? But that is not part of the conversation here. It's just
it never like, is.
It's just O'Brien being a good conduit for a conversation and offering to, like, O'Brien offers, you know, come over for dinner and like get your mind off of things. Bashir wants none of that. Instead, the button on the episode is Bashir walking Serena to the ship that she's going to board to leave him and this life forever. And what you're left with, what I was left with at the end of the episode, was that Serena is not damaged for this relationship with Bashir, though I think she could have been. Like, yeah. In alternate versions of this, I feel like things go very bad for her on her way out the door, and it affects her negatively in her life going forward. But instead, it feels like a mutual agreement that this is what's best for her, and so she goes.
It feels like an episode of Bashir like falling off a cliff and catching himself on a vine on the way down. Like he almost completely destroyed himself. And if she had been seriously harmed by what happened between them, I think he would have.
Yeah.
It's that like learning medical ethics the hard way kind of thing.
Right.
Like he sees how close he came to total destruction. And I think it's a good episode that is bad for Bashir as a character. But I think the most fucked up thing in the episode is the fact that they kiss on the mouth before she goes.
I thought a lot about this kiss in that in exactly the same way. I thought about the women in my life that I am close enough to give this kind of physical affection are few.
Yes.
And it is incredibly meaningful to know that that is all it is. And I'm not sure that one of these two kissers feels the same way.
No, yeah. I think that's well put. The fact that she is kind of... she's a galaxy brain and she is stupendously capable, but she is also inherently naive. She is new to the world. And there is a power imbalance in this moment. And there's a power imbalance all through the episode that Bashir consistently fails to, you know, rise to the occasion of being the better man about.
Mixed feelings about that moment. Did you like the episode, Ben?
You really want to do this here, now, okay, let's do it,
I did like the episode. I mean, I think we talked about The Sopranos. Like in a series like The Sopranos, if a character had an episode like that, it would haunt them for the rest of the series, you know? And I'm guessing that this will not haunt Bashir based on the track record of Deep Space Nine in the way that I think it should. But I think that this is also, you know, like we talk about, Deep Space Nine is one of the early TV shows to kind of come up with the idea of breaking away from the it's always reset at the end of every episode. And I think that in a vacuum, this is a really good episode because it is showing a guy failing himself and the people around him in a way that is really realistic. And as a viewer, you can like think about the times in your life when you've been around something like that, or if you yourself have made similar failings. Yeah. And I also think it's just like a really it's a well-structured story. It's well-acted. I think that Faith Saley is fucking amazing in it. I think Alexander Siddig is really good in it. And it's such crazy whiplash after Take Me Out to the Holosuite to have an episode as serious as this, too.
It's really true.
But overall, I thought it was a really strong episode.
I think scrutinizing the differences between how something is intended versus how it is received is really important in an episode like this. And I think depending on who you are and what your life experience has been like is going to put you all over the map on how this episode might work for you. I think what's interesting is Faith Saley sat for an interview about this episode fairly recently, and she thought it was good. Good in a post-Me Too environment, even.
Wow.
That Bashir was able to keep a professional remove with a patient in the way that he does in this episode was something that she approved of. And, I mean, if the actor portraying Serena thinks that, I mean, who am I to project what I think is right onto her and that character?
Yeah.
But I think an episode like this is emblematic of so much of the potential of a Dr. Bashir that has up until this point gone unrealized. I think his character as a tragic figure is something that could be mined to great effect. I think he could be more tragic even.
Yeah.
Why are we so narrowly confined with him and his stories when, like, what I want to feel is real trauma and real heartache with him instead of this middle ground stuff?
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is just a quality of late 90s television or what, but I did like the episode. But this is one of those ones where there's a little bit of meat on the bone and we're running out of time, you know, in the season and the series. And maybe we'll get another crack at Bashir going forward. I hope we do. But it's clear that he has been relegated to the sidelines as a major character, and he's getting one episode as an A story not very often. So if I were a betting man, I don't like his chances of getting a send-off that I would hope that he would get. Yeah. I mean, regardless of his actions in this episode, which, depending on your perspective, could be negative. One more thing I didn't say was this. Our X-Men here, I feel like, had they been introduced in season two, could have been our lone gunman of the series.
Oh, yeah. That's and this a great is it point.
This is it for them. They got their two episodes and they're out. I would have liked more of them sprinkled through. I mean, this is a way to give a greater foundation to the Bashir character is returning to this well. So
yeah.
I wish they'd done that.
Totally.
Also, where's the Nogby story here? Lauren is talking all about fucking Nog. Let's just give me one scene between Lauren and Nog.
Oh, man.
Like how tasty is that?
Oh, man.
What's he going to do with all that woman?
I feel like she would really love Umox.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I feel like Nog would be a giving lover, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that'd be a good fit.
This episode made me wonder, is Nog, like, 23 now? What's going on with Nog?
Nog's ready to fuck. I think we can agree.
He's a commissioned ensign in Starfleet, right? Like, this isn't a field commission. It's not provisional. He's a commissioned ensign.
I feel like an undone subtext to the Valiant episode is Nog looking around at that crew and going, they're all fucking each other. And I'm like virginal Nog at the academy.
What is the Federation Pie episode of Deep Space Nine?
Yeah.
Nog and Jake making a pact.
This cock is on fire with passion and love.
Adam, do you want to see if we have any Priority One messages?
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
But the interest alone could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first Priority One message is of a promotional nature.
Ooh.
Here's the message. Do you find yourself with lots of time and not enough awesome sci-fi to read? May I suggest Caitlin Morcos Interplanetary Marshal Service?
Wow.
Or more formally, She Who Is My Fourth Novel. Written by a guy who is a little bit embarrassed to write about starship battles and space crimes, Caitlin Morcos is a young marshal trying to chase an assassin while dealing with smugglers, slavers, and maybe even a traitor. She's a badass like Ro Laren. She's not really like Ensign Ro, but I do love that drop. So here's what you can do. You can go to mhquestus.com. That's mhquestus.com for links, or search for mhquestus on your local Amazon website. So here's a direction to go if you want fun to read.
I like a sci-fi novel. I'm going to see if I can get this. Caitlin Morcos,
Interplanetary Marshal Service. And this is like Star Trek as a place, right? We're telling Marshal Service stories in science fiction. This is a hell of a combination.
Wow. I like the design of the cover.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's like an aircraft carrier where the other people on the deck are wearing spacesuits.
I think when you're writing science fiction, you gotta have that cover done tight.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta have a great cover.
M.H. Questus left behind a career in physics for science fiction.
Yeah, physics is a dead end, man. No one cares about science anymore.
No, but honestly, I do like the authors of my sci-fi to have some grounding in the sci of their fi, you know?
It's what makes Greatest Gen so great. It's the it's the professional experience of its hosts.
Adam, our next priority one message is from She Who Does Burlesque, and it is to Bento Box and Adamantium. Oh, that's us.
I like those nicknames. Those
I'm
are some
Bento
great names.
Box and you're Adamantium.
Great names.
It goes like this. Hey guys, tis I, your girl, SWD Beezy. Just wanted to contribute to the show with a P1 purchase. In return, I wish you to have a discussion about who is the sexiest character on DS9 and why the answer is Garrick. Julian can come too if he keeps the water sports to a minimum. Hope you guys are having a safe apocalypse. Wow. This is an episode where I thought a lot about how much it would have been nice to have Garrick there, because we have a lot of Bashir trying to understand the world from Garrick's unique and strange point of view. And I thought it would be really cool in an episode like this to have Garrick, you know, like maybe one of those scenes with O'Brien, like rewrite it with Garrick. Because like all the ethics stuff when Garrick is in play change a lot.
You know, it's funny. Medically, it's so important to get a second opinion.
Yeah.
You'd think Bashir would know better.
Yeah.
And actually seek one out.
And also, like, Garrick, what are you doing making fake Starfleet uniforms? All of these things are questions we have.
Right. Yeah.
Why are we so thirsty for you, Garrick?
Yeah, it's true.
Anyways, if you'd like to cause us to talk about what a snack Garrick is, or you know, wish somebody well for their birthday, or sell your novel, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message, and we appreciate it because it helps us cover the cost of this production. Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda in this episode?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
I'm going to give my drunk Shimoda to Patrick. I think the way he snaps into and out of authority is this thing I really crave. He doesn't overdo it, which is a good bit of restraint by the episode. He does this magic trick twice.
Yeah.
And both times, it fucking kills. So Michael Keenan, the guy who plays Patrick, he doesn't have a ton to do, but what he does, he just fucking crushes. He's great. So it's going to be Patrick for me. What about you?
My drunk Shimoda is an alien that I saw a few times in this episode. Like, I feel like there are loafed aliens in the background on this show all the time. And some of the most interesting loaf you see in this series, you see as just background characters that we'll never meet. We will never know what their species is about, if they're a merchant species or a warrior species, or
they're iceberg aliens, Ben.
Yeah,
we'll never know what's going on beneath.
But they imply a richness to the tapestry of the Federation.
Indeed.
And there's this one alien that's got, like, I don't know if they're like tentacles or hair or what, but they're like three or four of them coming out the back of this alien's head, and one of them coming out of the front. And I saw this alien at least two times in this episode in different scenes. And it's such a distinctive loaf that it caught my attention every time I saw it. And what it made me think was probably what they do is, if there are going to be extras that they are going to the trouble of putting in loaf, that's all like scheduled for one day. And so anytime they're like on the promenade or in Quarks and they need a bunch of loafy people buzzing around in the background, that's one day of shooting. So any scene over the course of the episode that has background in it is going to be that day. And I think that there's like a tricky needle you have to thread as the costume department. Like, okay, like, we want these aliens to like look like interesting aliens, like that make you wonder what else is going on the station, but we don't want you to be distracted by them. We don't want you to be like wondering, like, why does that guy keep showing up in the background of shots? And this guy is like one like honestly the rare example of a failure in that respect, because he is in the background of a bunch of shots and it's just such a distinctive loaf. It's like gray makeup, but then the tentacles are like a red and white, like Christmas licorice sticks. I just kept clocking this character, and I wanted the episode to be about them.
Always working hard are the costume and makeup departments on this show. This seems to be an episode that we gave it a ton of attention. And I think attention that you could give every episode, but this one specifically really merits that.
Gotta get that gold press lacquer. Get that
gold press lacquer.
Am I right?
Moms, can't live with them, can't find a great gift for them. It's madness. And it's the same every year. Mother's Day comes around and it's like, what's it gonna be this year? Another robe? Another candle? Slippers? A sweater? Flowers? We've got to do better than that, right? Well, you can. And it's actually the best gift you could possibly give a loved one. An Aura frame. Now, we have a policy to only do ads on our show for things that we actually like and use. And I gotta tell you, the Aura frame is probably the best gift I've ever given. Folks I've given an Aura frame to love it, and I love it too, because when you give an Aura frame, you're not just giving a person a bunch of old pictures, you're giving them new pictures every time you send one to it. Right now, Aura has a great sale for Mother's Day. Viewers can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com, and the code is SCARVES at checkout to show your support for the show. Terms and conditions apply. When I was growing up, I didn't have anyone to tell me about personal grooming. I had to learn these things on my own. So I'm here to save you some embarrassment and recommend the grooming tools that I use. The products from Manscaped. Now, this is a company that constantly has its mind on your bush. Imagine the meetings they have. Imagine the pictures they have in their PowerPoint presentations. Now imagine your junk looking its best thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0. This thing is the latest Bonch trimming technology. With two interchangeable heads, a standard one for taking just a little off the top, and a new foil blade to go smooth wherever your heart desires. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
We've gone pretty long, Adam, but we need to get to how and why we will be doing our next episode of this show. The why is as follows. It's season 7, episode 6, Treachery, Faith in the Great River. Odo is thrust into a violent showdown when a Dominion War leader defects. Remember the war?
Yeah, that was weeks ago.
Yeah.
Is our break over? The war break?
Yeah, it would appear it is.
Guess we'll find out. No breaks built into the game of buttholes. Will of the Prophets. We're on square 59. Nice. And a couple squares ahead, we got a space butthole. A couple squares after that, the uber unpopular Starship Mine square.
Yeah, we've never hit that square, have we?
So we'll see what we get for what is definitely going to be a shorter episode for Ben to edit than today's episode, which is my task.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
I've got the die in my hand, and I'm going to give it a roll. And sure as shit, I've hit the space butthole.
Drink is the antidote.
We're back down to square 18 and a Quarks Bar episode, Ben.
Not going to be a short episode in that case.
No.
Mon frere.
You deserve this, you son of a bitch.
why is this my fault?
I've had a pattern of very long episode edits lately. I suppose that's been your pattern too. But we're really luxuriating in the recording of our show lately.
Yeah.
Maybe because there's just not anything else in our lives.
Yeah.
So there we are, square 18 next week, and the Mournhammered episode has never looked further away.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I doubt we'll hit it by the end of the season, and therefore by the end of the series at this point.
Right. Pretty wild to think about. I mean, there's a chance we roll a bunch of sixes, we could get there.
I guess so.
It's only episode 5 of the season. We've got 21 more episodes, Ben. That's 21 more rolls.
That's crazy. Well, that will be next episode, a drunk episode.
Yeah, a couple of Good Time Charlies will be us. One of the biggest Good Time Charlies in all of the Greatest Gen universe, Bill Tilly. He's the guy who's taking care of our social media needs lately.
He is.
You can find him at Greatest Trek on both Instagram and Twitter. You're going to find lots of fun content that he curates in both of those places.
Yeah, the thing that I have always hesitated about with my own social media since this show became a thing was I see a lot of interesting Star Trek things, but I don't want my personal social media feed to just be fun and interesting Star Trek stuff. And that's like the thing that Greatest Gen has become. It's like it is a fun thing to follow that will remind you about a funny character or tell you that it's Alexander Siddig's birthday or whatever, and it's a fun thing to have pop up in your feed. I really enjoy what Bill is doing with it.
When you're one of the two hosts of Greatest Gen, you don't want Star Trek to be your identity. Who would want that? Anyway, speaking of people who have changed identities, has anyone done it better than Adam Ragusea?
Mm.
He pivoted right out of legit collegiate work into food YouTubing.
Indeed.
That is a tube that will never deflate. He's got so many episodes about making great things to eat and growing plants and all sorts of things related to food making. You can find him at Adam Ragusea over on YouTube.
Speaking of things to follow and enjoy, check out our other shows. We've got Greatest Discovery, which is following all the new Star Trek programming that's coming out. As of the release of this episode, deep in the thick of the 23-week run of brand new Star Trek episodes airing on CBS All Access in the U.S. and various other platforms outside of the U.S. And also Friendly Fire, our hit war movie podcast that we make with our buddy John Roderick.
Big hit is Friendly Fire. Support for the show comes from those who go to MaximumFun.org/join and support us on a monthly basis. Their support is crucial to the ongoing production of this show. It's the only thing making the next episode possible.
And the only thing making our wives allow us to keep doing this.
And with that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine, which I would bet everything has a shorter title than the episode it's based on. Bet my entire life on that, Ben.
Interesting bet, given that I have the control over what that title winds up being.
I know. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. And also, we will forget about the bet by the time we record that episode, and by the time it's released, we won't remember any of this stuff, so.
Hey, one thing we did remember at the end is that you still win the card game, I think. I don't think my Bashir and Serena card is going to win.
Wow.
Card war.
Shit, dog.
so.
I forgot.
Like a steel trap, baby.
Make it so. Amazing. Make it so.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.